Good afternoon and welcome to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone. And if you're just joining us for the first time, we want to thank you for tuning in this afternoon and spending part of your Sunday afternoon with us. If you're a regular listener,
as I know all of you are.
Yeah. We know who you are, both of you. And hopefully we have a loyal following out there. What do you think, Sheena?
I think so. Yeah. How many family members do we have?
Between the two of us and Middleton, Stephen Middleton.
That's right.
Got to throw him a bone. We haven't this semester. But,
There you go. Shout out right there.
Yeah. So. Stephen's still listening to us in his shop every Sunday afternoon.
Okay. We'll have to bring him back, as a reward for being number one fan.
He's still terrified of talking on the radio for some reason. He gets all jittery when I ask him about joining us.
He's starstruck, honestly.
Maybe. You know, that's why he asks me for my autograph all the time at work.
Probably.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, so how are things for you with wrapping up the semester over at Student Health Center?
They are rocking and rolling. You got folks that are coming in and, all of a sudden, instead of wanting that spring break body, they want that summer body. So they're trying to figure out what to do with that. Or, I think you have a lot of folks that are like, hey, you know what? I'm going to be home for the summer. My schedule is not going to be as hardcore as it has been at school. I want to capitalize on self-care, including changing up my nutrition. I want to get in for an appointment before the semester is over, so I've got a game plan for the summer. And I love that. So you've got people that are wanting to be proactive with that, right. So that's great.
So I've never thought about that before. Could you say, roughly what percentage of that? That's great that people would plan ahead like that.
And
most people going back home to an environment that they're used to, they would probably be more comfortable in. So that's neat that they have planned ahead like that. Could you say what percentage
I would say for folks that are planning for the summer, anywhere between 25 to 50%. So that may be some that they know they're going to have a low-key summer and they want to really practice on that self-care. The other 25% of that may be folks that are going to travel across the country into a high-impact internship, and they're like, oh man, this is going to be crazy. I need a plan for food because my schedule is going to be even more stressful than it had been at school. So it's kind of fun seeing that too and getting students into a groove of potentially thinking about meal planning or maybe making healthier choices when they're going out to eat. They might be in an internship situation where they're going to be forced to eat out all the time. And maybe while they've been here at school, they had their apartment and could cook all the time. So just really equipping people for the summer in general, I would say at this point in time is taking up about 50% of my appointments, which is fantastic.
That's cool. Random question. And this just occurred to me. I had a friend back when the Olympics were in China. He took a graduate class over, and they spent some time at the Olympics and touring China and all that. But he had to go over, and he spent a couple of weeks over there preparing ahead of time. And one of the things that he said to me was, "You would not be able to survive over there," and just knowing how my eating habits. This is random, but if I'm going to some place where I don't have access to good old American food, could you help me if I go to China? Knowing what I eat, could you help me?
I could. And that's another thing, too. So you have a lot of students that are traveling overseas, and a lot of them are savvy enough to get to know the community area that they're in, so they know if they have access to a grocery store that has westernized food and everything else. You've got other folks that are kind of at the mercy of what their host family is serving. Actually, I had a student one time. She was like, I had a very specific eating schedule as a student here, and then I had my host family that really just introduced me to the magical wonder of having white rice at every meal, because she was in China. And she said it was so cool. She said, it's not how I normally would have eaten, but I wanted to be so respectful of that culture. So I think sometimes respect for that culture tends to override what someone's personal food preferences are. So it's kind of interesting, but I know you know, it's just one of those things you got to navigate. And
right.
I did have a faculty member. I know we got to take a break in just a second, but she's actually responsible for taking a group of students every other summer to all the fashion capitals across the world. And she is what I would, she is a John Jackson eater, i.e. picky.
Right.
And so she had a stipend for how much to spend on her eating in each of the countries. She literally ate Chipotle in every single country that they were in. So, you know, so stuff happens. There are a lot of westernized restaurants across the world. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting. I'm glad to know that you could help me navigate those waters if I ever had to do that.
Of course. But I guess we should take a break, huh?
Quick break. I do have a couple more questions about that before we get into our topic. And our, we have probably two of the best guests that we've had all semester with us, joining us today.
I would agree. I'm kind of blown away. But y'all, we're teasing you right now. You guys stick around, find out who it is. You are listening to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone.
Welcome back to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone. And we're back again this Sunday afternoon to continue our conversation that we just started. I do have a couple more questions for you about traveling abroad. And then, then we can get into, I guess we can introduce our guest today and get into our topic. For those of you that are just joining us, though, for maybe the first time, kind of quick overview of what we're about. We try to hit wellness topics, and I think we've done, as we're winding down the semester, I think we've done a really good job, thanks to you, as always, you know so many people, but of having a very well-rounded show when you look at the different wellness things that contribute to wellness. I think we've had a good
I agree.
Semester.
There's been a lot of diversity, and I think just kind of showing people how dynamic the concept of health is. I think sometimes, you know, we think about the concept of health and just think of it as merely being the absence of disease, or thinking of just the synonymous words of, you know, fitness or nutrition. But, you know, health just encompasses so much. So that's why I've loved just all the cool guests that we've had, including today's guests. So,
yeah, absolutely. So let's go ahead and break the ice on that.
Keep
everybody waiting. Our guests today are us.
That's right. Dr. John Jackson and Sheena Gregg, the foremost nutrition and fitness experts in the country. So,
absolutely.
Or at least maybe Tuscaloosa County or in this room.
We know for sure in this room.
Yes. Because our producer just left the room for a minute. So he might
have doesn't want to listen to us anymore. Oh, Cameron, we love you, man. But hey, real quickly, though, before we let's call this Sheena's Nutrition Corner.
Okay.
We're gonna put baby back in the corner, right?
Okay, yes, for sure.
For those of you that don't know, that was a reference to
last week's show and Dirty Dancing.
Okay,
so
there we go.
So you gotta catch up, you know, our show's online. So
And we're on top of these cultural references.
Right.
Is that what you'd call that?
That's right.
Anyway, going back real quickly, the one question I wanted to ask you about going back to China specifically, because we were talking about that, but fast food in different countries, it's not always fast food like you would find here.
No, and you could have, you know, whatever kind of, say, chain restaurant, just for sake of example, we'll say like a McDonald's or whatever else.
Okay.
The menu options in China are not going to be like the ones in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And I can even tell you from personal experience, having visited the Philippines. So in the Philippines, at the McDonald's there is spaghetti on the menu. Would you ever think about having spaghetti at McDonald's or another fast food restaurant?
If I was in the Philippines, I might have to.
Right.
But but that's interesting.
Yes.
So are there staples pretty much that you would find at any McDonald's,
Probably could. You know, I think with the burgers, now one thing that I will say, and I don't know if this is just the Philippines, China may be like this too, but the pickles on burgers at fast food restaurants, it was only the sweet pickles. They did not have the regular, I guess what I'd call more of the like salty, acidic type of pickles that we have here. It would be like the sweet pickles that we have, but don't necessarily think about putting those on our burger. So
right.
I don't know. I need to do some research on why that is. Is that flavor profile just not very popular in those countries, or they just really love those sweet pickles? So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you one thing, and we'll move on to our topics for today.
Sure.
As a pickle hater,
okay.
I will confess something on the air that no one's ever heard me say out loud before.
Oh, I'm holding my breath. Okay.
Yeah, if you're ready for this. I have resorted to, at times, occasionally, saying that I was allergic to pickles.
Really?
So to make sure that they don't just take them off.
Yes, because then you have that pickle juice
that you can't get rid of.
Yeah. Now, we have other chains in place. So Chick-fil-A, they have pickles on their sandwiches. Do you adamantly say, or do you eat there? Or
that I will say there are certain places in Tuscaloosa that are really good about getting it right, and you don't have to worry about it. There are other places, and I'm going to try to make myself feel a little bit better about this. I'm going to say that if I were to eat a pickle, something bad really could happen to me because I hate it that bad.
Okay.
So is it possible to say that I'm allergic to it for that reason?
Maybe allergic is not the appropriate word. I would say you have an intolerance. That is, you know, something very legitimate happening within your GI system, or there is such a huge mind-body connection that mentally, because you have abstained and have chosen and decided no pickles, that would result in some tummy aches, because mentally your mind is starting to give those signals to your brain, to your tummy, reject this. So
we wouldn't get that far. We're talking immediate projectile vomiting. Okay.
So I'll just say an intolerance at this point, if we want to be as accurate as possible.
Good information. I could sit and talk to you all day because you're full of such good information.
Sometimes it's random information. I might be good at doing, trivia one night with just really random topics. And
I've seen you do that before. Yeah. Yes. But I will say though, it's not just for this show. I really could sit and listen to you all day. I've heard you do so many talks, and we're going to get on with the show here in a second. But I've heard you do so many talks, and you're like, I used to have a baseball coach that we would do camps for kids, and I would try to get with him. I was a pitcher, he was a hitting coach. So I didn't get to spend a lot of time around him, but he had to give the same talk over and over throughout the day. Mm-hmm. I could listen to him all day, going on and on with the same talk. You're the same way. I could listen to you because I always learn something from you all the time.
Well, thank you. So. I appreciate it. That will inspire me to continue to do well in this field. So thank you.
Well, let's see. I want to test your knowledge today.
Okay, let's do it.
No trivia here today. What we're talking about today, guys, and hopefully this will be a good learning experience for everybody, not just me. what we just decided to do today, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about our two strong suits, the fitness and nutrition. And so we came up with some what we consider controversial topics.
I agree, yes.
And just going to toss out some questions to each other about those things, and we'll see how this goes. First thing I have to jump on with you is the gluten-free diet thing is huge now.
Yes.
And you hear people talking about it all the time. One of the things that I did read is that studies are starting to show that it increases the risk of type 2 diabetes. Is that correct?
It can. I think, it really depends on how someone approaches a gluten-free diet. Of course, I would tell anyone who has a medical reason to abstain from gluten, whether they have celiac disease or they're on the spectrum for gluten intolerance, please, abstain from gluten. But you have folks that are choosing to abstain from gluten because they believe it would be helpful in terms of weight loss. And when you think about the products that have gluten, essentially gluten is a protein that is in wheat, barley, and rye products. And so what I will sometimes notice with my folks that are going gluten-free is they might, you know, a food that would naturally or typically have gluten, like say pasta or their favorite crackers or whatever else, they'll buy the gluten-free version of that. And what they don't realize is that when companies are taking gluten out of a product that would normally have gluten, they've got to replace that flavor with something else. And so usually they're going to add more sugar to that product, more fat to that product, more sodium. So sometimes those gluten-free pretzels or Oreos might have more calories or sodium or fat or whatever else compared to the ones that did contain gluten. So that's where you could definitely see there being a higher risk for type 2 diabetes because they're replacing it with another type of processed carbohydrate. The absence of gluten isn't necessarily making something more healthy. So I think the better choice would be to go with a naturally gluten-free product, like maybe having rice or sweet potatoes or quinoa. So you're still getting those good carbs in there, but not necessarily choosing a gluten-free food that would normally have gluten in it. Like, oh, this special, you know, sugary cereal that would normally have gluten, I'm going to choose gluten-free. And then they don't realize the companies had to add a bunch of other things that aren't so great to make up for the fact there's no gluten in there. So, yeah.
So bottom lining it then, Sheena's take is don't go gluten-free unless you need to for medical purposes.
Correct. Correct. You know, there's a lot of messaging that's out there. You know, of course, you know, food industry is politically driven and everything else. And so, you know, just be an informed consumer. But yeah, like you said, bottom line is don't go gluten-free unless you have to. So,
okay. Great. I know we got to take a quick break, but I have a follow-up question for you after the break.
Okay, y'all, you heard it. We got to take another break. You are listening to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone.
We survived another break.
We did.
We survived another break. You're listening to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John, 90.7 The Capstone, and we're continuing our conversation here with Sheena and myself. And I want to jump right back into this, Sheena.
Yes.
We're talking nutrition and fitness questions, some controversial type issues, and you just finished giving a great explanation of gluten-free diets and when that's appropriate, and that's really good information. Something I don't know much about
that
has just recently come to my attention is low FODMAP eating.
Yes.
Okay. Did I say that correctly?
You did. I'm very proud of you.
Okay.
So, you know, when it comes to low FODMAP, you may or may not have seen it in the media. I have been really exposed to it over the past few years. For anyone who may be in a circumstance where you have IBS, aka irritable bowel syndrome, you might be working with a gastrointestinal specialist that has recommended you go on a low FODMAP diet. And so sometimes when people do the research on their own, they're like, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to cut out all this food. And basically FODMAP is an acronym for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. And essentially it's a group of foods. They're specifically carbohydrates. And going on a low FODMAP diet isn't something that someone would have to go on forever. Typically, it's what's considered an elimination diet. So you would go on it for about 2 to 6 weeks. And FODMAP-containing foods don't necessarily cause IBS, but taking FODMAP foods out of your diet can help with IBS symptoms, if that makes sense. And basically, the way these foods work is that there are certain groups of the FODMAPs that irritate your stomach because they naturally pull a lot of water into your gut, and that can be very irritating for your GI system. There's another set of the FODMAPs. Their mechanism of action is they pull in a lot of gas into your GI system. So kind of you could visually think of it like a certain group of FODMAPs pull a lot of water into your tummy, kind of like filling up a water balloon, and it kind of gets more distended and probably uncomfortable. You could think of the other FODMAPs that put that gas into your system like heating up a hot air balloon. afternoon. You know, it's just really, right. And so when you go on this, you know, you're going to kind of eliminate all those foods all at once. And then there's different categories that you take out. And so you might be listening and thinking like, well, what's a food that is high FODMAP? Right. So I have my list. And so that's going to be a lot of your foods that have lactose. So milk sugars. So think milk, ice cream, yogurts, different types of cheeses. Also excess fructose. Fructose is fruit sugar. So apples, mangoes, watermelon, honey, agave. But that's not to say every fruit is on this list. Other types of foods on the list can include cashews, garlic, onions, dried fruits, mushroom, cauliflower. So when you look at the list, if you were to do research on your own, you might think like, gosh, there's a lot I've got to cut out. But you want to look for a list of foods that are low FODMAP, as in foods that you can eat, and you would be surprised at like, wow, I can still have a very normal, healthy diet. I just got to temporarily cut out the milk and the apples and whatever else. So yeah. And then usually gluten containing foods are going to be part of the FODMAP kind of type thing. So a lot of times you'll see those correlated.
So that's why. Okay.
Yeah. Great. Oh yeah, for sure. Sorry, I went into such a lengthy response with that.
That's great. It's good information. And I'm apparently a FODMAP eater.
Yeah.
I guess so. That sounds like a lot of things that I eat. So.
Yeah. I'll show you the legal FODMAP foods, and then you'll probably be like, oh yeah, I'm totally.
that's totally me.
But yeah. Can we switch gears?
Can I
put you in the hot seat?
Absolutely. Okay. I'll be your guest.
Okay. Thank you. So thank you, Dr. John Jackson.
So
when we think about fitness, I'll just say even personally for me, you know, over the past year, kind of going into different types of exercise routines at different facilities, just so that I could hit all of those aspects of fitness. I've heard a lot of different things about static stretching versus dynamic stretching. And I have no idea what that is.
Right.
Tell me what that is. Please enlighten me.
Well, I will tell you that dynamic stretching is kind of the trend now.
Okay.
And dynamic stretching is basically moving a joint throughout its range of motion.
Okay.
While you're moving.
Okay.
So it's basically a traveling stretch.
Think,
for example, a lunge without weights.
Yes.
And maybe a walking lunge without weights, where you're covering about a 10 to, you know, 20 yard area. So it's basically exercises like that, or stretches like that, I should say. A great way to see this in action is if you were to get to a baseball game early.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my sport, you get to a baseball game early and you see a lot of the players out stretching on their own.
Yes.
And they're walking or they're moving at not a fast pace, not a jog, but they're doing different movements, and that's what they're doing is a dynamic stretch.
Okay.
Okay, that's kind of the trend now, as opposed to the old, what is static stretching? And it used to be the only kind of stretching, for the most part, that was recommended, where you take a joint to the end of its range of motion, you take it to the point to where it's slightly uncomfortable, and you hold it there for about 20 to 30 seconds.
Okay.
That's what we're familiar with.
Sure, sure. So kind of like a cool down from like a workout, and then they do a little stretching session or whatnot.
Absolutely,
okay.
Absolutely. Static means still, so you're not bouncing, you're not moving.
Mm-hmm.
You just hold it at that point of slight discomfort for a certain amount of time. You want to try to isolate the muscle or the joint. The disadvantage of doing that type of stretch primarily is that the place where you feel that stretch on that muscle is the only part of that muscle that is being lengthened for the most part.
Okay.
Whereas in a dynamic stretch and you're carrying it throughout its full range of motion, you're probably getting more of a full muscle stretch.
Sure.
But what I would say is one is not necessarily better than the other. I would recommend probably dynamic stretching prior to a workout.
Okay.
Static stretching is better after you're good and warmed up. So if you're going to do one before, one after, or just choose one, dynamic stretching would probably be better before. And then static stretching is better for after. And I will say this, if you're about to strength train, static stretching prior to strength training is bad.
Really?
And not in a way that it would hurt you, but it decreases your overall strength. Okay. If you do static stretches prior to
sounds it. Just not as helpful.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So that's good to know. Okay. So, well, now I feel enlightened, and I feel like I've experienced both situations then in the different types of workout classes that I've been in. So now I'm like, right. Oh, I know exactly what kind of stretching this is. So that's good.
Right. Yeah. And I tell you what, dynamic stretches are a great way. If you're getting ready, if you can find a dynamic stretching routine mm-hmm. that's about 15 to 20 minutes mm-hmm. When put together properly, and that's one of the things that having a fitness professional help you with is great. But if you can get one that is already put together and in the proper order, if you can do that for about 15 to 20 minutes, you go into your workout with a good sweat going on. There's not a better feeling in the world because you're ready to work out.
Okay.
You're ready to lift weights. You're ready to do whatever cardio you want to do.
Okay. Okay. I'm feeling re-inspired with it.
Right.
I'm like, okay, I should probably start exercising.
All right. All right. Real quickly, can I ask you, can
of
we
course.
Go back to the nutrition question?
Yes, we totally can.
Okay. Activated charcoal. I've seen some advertisements for these types of detox things.
Yes. So with activated charcoal, you know, as you can imagine, charcoal is black. You might have seen some activated charcoal foods or beverages that are out there. And essentially, the way the charcoal is activated is it goes through a special like heating and chemical process. A lot of clinicians that work in substance abuse programs will sometimes give activated charcoal to get certain toxins out of someone when they've had an overdose or whatever else. And so people have been trying to use that concept to go on a detox diet themselves. And this can actually be really harmful to the body or okay. not helpful, because basically when you're taking in that activated charcoal, it's only the activated charcoal basically kind of acts as a magnet or a sponge to kind of get this stuff out of you. And that's really only going to be in your stomach. So it's not going to get toxins that have built up in your body. It's just going to get toxins that are in your stomach at the time. But it's not only going to absorb toxins, it's going to absorb vitamins, right. minerals, other types of nutrients. So it's almost like that activated charcoal can't be like, oh, this is a toxin, I need to grab it. Oh, that's a vitamin or mineral, I'll leave it. It's just going to absorb everything. So that's not so great. So I tell folks, you know what, if you're trying to think of a detox, you've actually got a really great system in place called your liver and your kidneys. It's really, I mean, probably one of the best things on the market. And so that's what I would say about that. So with the activated charcoal, it won't, you know, it's not going to be overly dangerous. It's just honestly not going to be helpful. And if anything else, it might affect the absorption of the good stuff you're trying to keep in your body. So
nice.
Yeah.
So when we say supervised, we're going to do a detox supervised by a fitness, not a fitness, a nutrition professional.
Yes.
You wouldn't even supervise one. You say don't do it at all.
Right.
Most
yeah.
circumstances.
Yeah, most circumstances. So, you know, there's going to be other circumstances where medically somebody might need whatever kind of situation. But yeah, for the most part, your kidneys and liver, I mean, they're pretty banging.
They're
pretty amazing.
They're there for a reason.
Yes. But it's time for another break.
We're flying.
We're rolling through this stuff. Okay, you guys, stick with us. We got some more controversial fitness and nutrition topics. You are listening to Fit to be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone. Welcome back. You are listening to Fit to be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone this Sunday afternoon. If you are just now joining us, this is a great time to join us because we are talking about some pretty hot and top, you know, controversial nutrition and fitness topics. And so, of course, John, you know, I want to throw it back to you with another fitness question. And in this one, I would say I'm actually personally interested in, because this will probably be the first time I'm saying it on air, I'm pregnant. And I have heard, as I've been researching, you know, proper fitness for myself as a pregnant woman, you know, having to be really careful with certain types of movements that would not be disruptive to my abdominal area. And a lot of that has to do with some twisting movements and things of that nature. So when you think about the topic of spinal flexion and rotation versus core stability, kind of talk to me about that.
First off, congratulations for the first time to be able to say it publicly.
Thank you.
I'm so happy for you. I can't believe there's going to be a little she-dog running around here.
I know, me neither. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, but I'm so excited for you and Terry both. That was, like, great. Back to your question.
Yes.
Obviously, being pregnant is a specific condition, and sure, there are certain things that go along with that. Mm-hmm. But going back to, and we could get into that. That's a totally off the wall topic.
Yeah.
There are specific things with that. But one thing that you see a lot of people doing now, and where the controversy is in this, you see people doing a lot of rotational type exercises, right, whether it's, you know, whatever side to side twisting type abdominal movement, mm-hmm, whether regardless of what type of position you're in to start with, if you're twisting while you're crunching your abs or flexing your abs,
sure,
it is, I'm not going to say it's going to hurt you, but your abdominal muscles, your core muscles, your low back, your abdominal muscles, they were made to, they're designed to hold your spine in place.
Mm-hmm.
They're not designed to twist your spine. I mean, obviously, certain muscles help you twist your body. But ideally, the muscles that you're working when you're doing an ab workout help stabilize the spine and keep, mm-hmm, it as still as possible,
okay,
which helps prevent injury.
Okay.
And so, ideally, any type of abdominal movement, I always tell people, everybody has a six pack. It's just what is hidden underneath.
Sure.
Now, the level of detail that you have in your six pack or eight pack or whatever, you can get, you know, you want to have good strong abs. You want to have good, you want to balance it out with good strong lower back muscles as well. But you would definitely want to minimize any type of twisting movement. Like I said, over the long term, it's probably potentially dangerous,
mm-hmm,
especially when you're using resistance. I see people doing it, you know, heavy weights,
sure,
and twisting. That's scary. But ideally, we want to keep that plane, you know, straight up and down when you're doing crunches and keep that twisting to a minimum.
Okay. So if someone was doing something like, you know, like bicycle crunches or whatever else, and there is that twisting action, what would be something that I guess could essentially be safer while still targeting those obliques, you know, those side areas?
You know, it's difficult to explain exactly how to do it, but anything where you're side lying,
mm-hmm,
okay,
sure,
and basically crunching as straight up as you can, mm-hmm, but you're if you can target your obliques as much as you could possibly,
yes,
target them,
yes,
that's the way to go.
Okay,
but one thing I see people doing a lot is basically just the old side bends where they take, you know, heavy dumbbells in each hand and they go side to side,
mm-hmm,
with them.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing that, and I try to tell as many people as I can this, essentially when you're using a heavy weight and you're lifting a heavy weight, you're causing your muscles to potentially grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the last thing anybody would probably want to do with that area because it's making your waist thicker.
Mm-hmm.
I've never
thought about it like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So from strictly an aesthetic perspective, it's not going to help you. So question number one, I always tell people, if you're going to do an exercise, what is the purpose of doing it?
Right.
And if your purpose of, if you're trying to do something twisting abdominal with your abdominals, there's only so much you can get from it. And the risk versus reward is pretty high. So I would stay away from those types.
Okay.
Of things.
Man, I'm learning so much this afternoon. You talk about learning stuff with me. But yeah, no, this is great. Okay, so I got another question.
Okay.
So low reps versus high reps. You know, I see that, you know, over the years when I've even working in a fitness facility myself in high school, I would, you know, hear people talk about, you know, even supersets and all this kind of stuff. So low reps versus high reps, you know, shoot it to me.
Well, what I would say is this is both are good,
mm-hmm,
depending on what you're trying to accomplish. And in an overall workout routine, when you're thinking long term over the course of your life or, you know, over the course of years, you know, working in rep schemes where you're using low reps and high reps or different combinations of that is fine. How you define low reps and how you define high reps is basically one thing you need to look at first. Low reps, generally we consider low reps 6 reps or less.
Okay.
All right. Now, we're not talking 6 reps or less with a super lightweight. Mm-hmm. We're talking about fatigue at six reps. So that being said, to use a weight that will fatigue you at 6 reps is potentially putting you at risk for injury. But there's nothing, I mean, in a controlled situation, that's okay. I mean, you know, you got that risk-reward thing.
Sure.
You're wanting to grow muscles. You're wanting to increase your power with 6 reps or less.
Okay.
That's the way you want to go.
Okay.
If you want to increase your strength, we're talking about the 8 to 15 rep range.
Right.
That's going to help increase your strength more than anything else. And, again, we're talking fatigue at the end of a set. You can't do any more than 15 reps.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to get you what most people probably would want in that middle range. Now, when we define high reps, a lot of people you see just cranking out rep after rep after rep. Okay, nothing wrong with that, but what I like to consider that point of diminishing returns, if you can get past 20 with the weight, what you're working is muscular endurance at from 15 to 20 reps.
Mm-hmm.
That's great for you. But you can only get so many benefits past that point.
Right.
So
right.
20 is the magic number if you want to say high reps.
Okay. No, and that's good to know. I mean, especially too, if, you know, I'm killing it at, you know, whatever rep number and, you know, I'm not being fatigued, probably time to move
increase
up in weight. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Good to know.
All right. Back to you.
Yes.
And after we do this, we're going to go on a quick speed round, but I want to get your take real quickly also on intermittent fasting.
Yes.
Oh gosh.
There's a lot of controversy out there. You know, I would say that there are certainly some folks out there that are team yay and team no with it. And I think so just to kind of clarify what intermittent fasting is that you are fasting for different periods of time and kind of interspersing that with just normal eating. I think three of the most popular styles, there's one where maybe people choose like 1 or 2 days a week where they're limiting their calories to maybe 500 calories a day. And then
okay.
the other days of the week, they're going to their quote unquote normal eating.
Okay.
Then there's other types of intermittent fasting where maybe throughout the day, they are only allowing themselves to eat for 8 hours of the day, and then the other 16 hours of the day, they're fasting.
Okay.
And then there's another type of intermittent fasting where people are choosing a handful of days a week where there literally is no food being consumed at all. So it's a 24-hour fast, and then they return to normal eating the next day and kind of teeter-totter back and forth between the two. So some people like it because on the days that they can eat, for the most part, there's no restriction to what it is. It's, you know, if it can go in your mouth, you know, it's free game. But, you know, on your fasting days, you just don't eat, you know, and you have calorie containing beverages like water and tea and coffee. So I think part of what has made it popular again is because when people eat, they can eat whatever they want to. There was a study done in 2011 where it actually compared intermittent fasting with someone just going on a low calorie diet overall.
Right.
And they were pretty comparable in terms of the weight loss and fat mass. What was seen with the intermittent fasting, though, is that the intermittent fasting actually retained more lean body mass. So
okay.
that was something that was a pro. But again, that's just one study. But you know
right.
how people like to cling to one thing.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
You know, if they're trying to make a point, I would say as a dietitian that on the days you're fasting, you're going to become really irritable. You're going to miss out on a lot of nutrition. So the day that you're rebounding back to normal eating, you're not going to eat normal, sensible, healthy portions. You're going to go big or go home because that day you were fasting, you were probably fantasizing about that ice cream or burger.
Right, right.
And you're going to take care of business the next day. And that does not really offer a healthy way to eat. So this isn't going to be great for people who have chronic conditions like diabetes.
Right.
Certainly someone who has a history of an eating disorder, that's not going to be great too. So I'm not going to say that I would just tell someone to never ever consider it. It's just not something that I would normally recommend to someone.
Okay.
Yes.
At all.
And yeah.
Stay away from it.
Yes.
And again, like you always say, I've heard you say it a million times, moderation.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just not a fan of really extreme styles of anything.
Right.
So, yeah.
Good deal. Okay, we got to take one last quick break.
Yes.
And then we're going to come back and do a little quick speed round.
Yes.
And then we're going to go to Sheena Talks About a Food.
I am down with that. Okay, so let's take this break, you guys. You are listening to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone.
Welcome back to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone. And we're going to wrap things up with a little speed round here of controversial topics. Everything has flown by this afternoon, but we have to save time for my favorite topic. Sheena Talks About a Food.
Yes.
So real quickly, and we're not going to answer these questions thoroughly for you.
Yes.
Please understand that going into this.
Yes.
We're going to ask a couple questions real quickly and give our quick opinion on it. If you want more, email us.
Yes.
Our email address is on the station's website.
That's correct.
And send us an email, and we'll be glad to follow up. In more detail if you have questions.
Yes.
About it.
Okay. I got a question for you.
Okay.
Interval training versus steady state cardio.
Okay. Both have advantages. There are advantages to each. Most of the time when people do cardio, they're doing it to lose weight.
Right.
But you also get those heart benefits as well. Again, both are good. You'd want to do both of them. Probably the best benefit, the best bang for your buck, interval training, and interval training where you're going really, really hard for a certain period of time and then recovering.
Okay, very nice. Okay, I got a follow-up.
Okay.
Okay, so how about advanced monitoring techniques versus doing a wellness questionnaire?
Okay, a lot of people don't see that necessarily would think about this, but a personal trainer would look at this for you.
Yes.
Advanced monitoring techniques, we're talking about wearables, things that you see people, whether it's just the good old-fashioned heart rate monitor or the more fancy things that are out there now. What we know is the technology is so good now that if you have something that you can afford to wear and it makes you aware of what you're doing, go for it.
Right.
Because, it's going to make you aware of it. A wellness questionnaire could be something as simple as this. It's not actually a questionnaire necessarily, but it could be like where you create your own scale, a 1 to 10 scale, 6 to 20 scale, comparable type things. There are those scales that are out there, and basically when you create that scale, you're doing cardio or you're working out, you're lifting, you would want to say you're like at a 6 or 7 at least on a 1 to 10 scale, at least a 13 or 14 on a 6 to 20 scale.
Okay.
Your heart rate is going to correspond with that.
Nice.
Research shows it.
Okay. Love it, love it, love it.
Okay, questions for you.
Yes.
Something I've seen recently, caffeine-infused foods.
Yes. So bottom line, people aren't necessarily wanting to get their caffeine from coffee or sodas. So, the food industry is picking up on that. People want a pick-me-up. So, when you think about caffeine, it can be really great when you haven't had a good night's sleep. It actually helps improve your brain's short-term memory by affecting your brain's prefrontal cortex. So caffeine can be really great, but in moderate amounts. So moderate could be anywhere between 200 to 300 milligrams, depending on the person. If you go too high in your caffeine, you're going to experience irritability, low blood sugar, nausea, diarrhea. So that's where caffeine's not going to be so great. Another thing, too, is it typically takes the average person to get about, it takes about 3 to 4 hours for caffeine to be eliminated from your system. So if you have trouble going to sleep at night, you probably don't want that caffeinated chocolate bar or granola bar at 6 o'clock at night if you have a distinct bedtime you are trying to hit.
Gotcha.
So yes.
Great. You spent a lot of time talking about the gut today.
Yes.
So we're going to try to move away from that. There is a great increase in popularity of plant proteins now.
Yes.
Your take on that.
That is correct. So definitely a big fan of people that may be going vegetarian or vegan. The thing you want to do if you are going to go with more plant-based proteins is you want to make sure that you're eating as many of the different types of plant-based proteins that are possible. You don't want to choose to go plant-based in your eating and be a really picky eater because that's going to limit limit you. But really, you know, the research is indicating that we don't need as much protein as the standard American diet promotes. You can completely get all that you need from plant-based proteins. I think we just have been convinced it's got to be a big old hot steak in front of us.
Right.
So, yes.
Great answer. Good. Very quick, concise, to the point.
Thank
now,
you.
On to my favorite thing. We're going to change speeds.
Yes.
We're going to slow it down just a little bit here.
Yes.
Sheena talks about a food. and I am here by myself. You're going to describe a food for me.
I am.
And we'll see if I can guess it. And then after that, I know you probably have a recipe to go with this food.
I do,
okay,
yes.
All right, let's see if I can
Okay, guess. So fun fact. So this food originated as far back as 6,000 BC. There are more than 2,000 varieties of this food available worldwide. The people of Greece are the largest consumer of this food. The average person in Greece consumes about 60 pounds of this food every year. Pizza Hut is the largest purchaser of this food to use in their products. It uses approximately 300 million pounds of this food annually. The production of this food around the globe is more than the combined worldwide production of coffee, tobacco, tea, and cocoa beans. This food's an excellent source of protein, calcium, and phosphorus. And this food has been shown in studies to help prevent tooth decay by promoting the flow of saliva, and also protects tooth enamel and has an antibacterial effect.
For the record, we do not talk about these ahead of time, and this may be the first one that I've ever gotten right, and I hope I'm not wrong. Is it cheese?
Yes!
Yes, finally,
yay!
After all this time.
Oh, yay! Okay, so okay. It is cheese. What tipped you off?
You know, there were several things, but you laid out a few facts that, yeah, I didn't know. The saliva thing,
yes,
didn't know.
Yes.
And there were a couple other things that you threw out there that might would have thrown me for a little bit of a loop, but I was solid on most of
okay,
that.
Okay, very good. Well, our recipe is a one-pan broccoli, bacon, mac and cheese. So we can take the broccoli out for our folks if you want to. It's actually
let's go healthy.
Yeah,
let's go healthy.
Well, you're asking for healthy. This is from the Cooking Light website. Not only does it have, you know, your traditional cheese and bacon and all that stuff, it's also got some butternut squash that is hidden in there to add some creaminess where you're not having to use as much cheese. Right. So yeah. Anyways,
interesting.
Yes.
And how can our listeners get this recipe?
Yes. So we'll actually be able to tweet it out, have it available on the website, get it out to you guys. So it's going to be fantastic. But
great.
Man, such a great show.
Too fast. I enjoyed
yes,
it. Great
I know.
Day
so we got it. We got to do another thing like this.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
You guys enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Yes.
And have a fabulous week. You have been listening to Fit to Be Tied with Sheena and John on 90.7 The Capstone.